Guys, after World War II, nothing seemed more natural than owning your own home. And really, nothing seemed more up to the individual.
Yeah.
If you got a good job, you made some money, you bought a home, maybe you moved to the suburbs. And I think this story about the Contract Buyers League and Clyde Ross shows us how important the rules of the game are. And I think it's worth pausing here to talk about just how much home ownership had to do with purely individual choice and how much it had to do with the larger set of rules in play. Certainly in my century, the government really shaped many of those rules. Peter, I'd be curious to know, back in your period, how much did the government shape those rules?
Well, I think it's important that there were rules. The myth of American expansion is that settlers, entrepreneurial, adventurous settlers, moved out into virgin land, mixed their labor with it, and made it their own. And those property rights then were recognized by the state. But it goes just in the opposite direction. It's important to point out that Chicago was part of the Northwest Territory originally, and before that it was, well, guess what, Indian country. But American policymakers believed that they were public lands, that is, they were belonged to all Americans, and then they were privatized. If it weren't for the state, if it weren't for its rules, if it weren't for the removal of Native Americans by the action of the federal state, getting them out of there, then those lands would never have become available to become private property. And so that whole process suggests that rather than property rights being natural, self-generated by enterprising individuals, they are very much a function of the state.
You know, the culmination of this, Peter, I think, comes in 1862 in the Homestead Act. It's the homestead. That
right.
must be
That's
good,
a
right?
Beautiful thing, yeah.
By this point, the lands literally feel empty to the white settlers pouring in there. And, of course, this is happening in the middle of the Civil War, yep. at the very same time that another drama that's played out around this same matrix of law and custom and race and business. And that is, what is going to happen to the 4 million people held in slavery for 200 years who had cleared the land that is the South? And, of course, we all know the phrase that was used, that was held out, 40 acres and a mule, which was, in fact, a government policy that was discussed. Wouldn't it be fair to give the enslaved people 40 acres? And the mule is the machine that you have to till it, to make mm-hmm. it a farm. And, unfortunately, this dream emerges in the wake of the war, as the war is coming to an end in 1865. But almost as soon as that emerges, it's extinguished. Almost as soon as the government holds out the hope that it may be ready to do for enslaved people what it had done for white settlers, it's snatched back.
That's because of those property rights, right, Ed?
I mean, yeah,
the land was already owned, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. We know that these southern slave owners had risen up in rebellion against the United States, but even more important than that, they had property rights. And you simply cannot put the country back together if you're going to take the property, the homes, away from the white landowners. And so for the next two or three generations, the formerly enslaved people and their children try to make a place for themselves in the South. They save and combine their resources in every way they can to buy even the smallest piece of land. But these are the direct sources of the story in Chicago, because despite all that work, all that sweat, all that sacrifice, African Americans of that region there along the Mississippi find themselves steadily more dispossessed rather than getting a chance to buy into the American dream. And despairing, they feel the only way they have a chance is to go to Chicago and the other cities.
So it's not go west, young man. It's go to the big city, young man.
Exactly.
Guys, let me just add a postscript. A lot of people thought that discrimination would be ended when Congress passed the Fair Housing Act of 1968. The Fair Housing Act stated that discrimination based on race, based on other factors, was illegal. But then a very funny thing happened. We had the deregulation of the housing market. The government said, you know, yes, let's step back. Let's let the market decide who's creditworthy and who is not creditworthy. The problem came in that some of these corporations continued to discriminate not based on creditworthiness, but based on the color of people's skin. And we know that Bank of America, countrywide division, discriminated against minorities, steered them into riskier, higher cost mortgages solely based on their minority status. We know this because the Justice Department sued Bank of America, and Bank of America settled with the Justice Department for $350 million. So this push and pull between what is clearly an American ideal and the reality of American practices continues even today.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, what to do when your house fights back.
You're listening to Backstory. See you in a minute.
This is Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow, 20th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the guy in the middle in the 19th century.
And I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century history guy. Today on our show, homeownership, the bittersweet dream. Each week while we're putting our show together, we invite some listeners to call in and ask us their questions. So, guys, let's do it. All right, we have a call from Gettysburg, PA, and it's Carrie. Carrie, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, thanks.
Hey, great to have you on the show. And you have a question about home ownership.
Yes. So right now I am a student at the Lutheran Seminary in Gettysburg, mm-hmm. and that sort of colors my question.
Ooh.
From sort of your historical perspective, mm-hmm. what has the role of the church been in encouraging home ownership or not, including sort of the church's role as a homeowner in providing like parsonages? Did churches play any role in sort of drawing people to the community and encouraging them to stay and put down roots and buy homes?
What a wonderful question. And that's the role of the church in the history of American real estate. The church, the home of God, the house of God. What is its relationship to the homes of mere mortals, Ed?
Well, it's one of the things it points out that if we were talking about Catholics, we'd be talking about a very different kind of home than if we're talking about Protestants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea of the parsonage is that there is a family, probably,
yes.
associated with the pastor, and you require something much like a home. And I'm guessing that this is actually quite reassuring to Protestants compared to a monastery or a nunnery, which are, in the 19th century, places of deep suspicion for Protestants. And so I think that the parsonage is a sort of an instant welcoming sort of symbol, but also a domesticating symbol.
That's great, Ed. Let me spin a little bit earlier on that same theme, because I think it's an important one. And you bring up the Protestant thing. We're having a religious call here. That is, in Puritan New England, the church itself, the meeting house, is not sacred space. And this is a rejection of the Catholic notion in the big cathedrals and in the churches that these are consecrated sacred spaces. And the corollary of that, I think, is important for Carrie's question, because if there's nothing particularly special about the meeting house, there is something about every house that's special. In a way, every house is a house of God, because that's the site of family worship.
Right. Which is really the core of Puritan faith, is it
yes,
not, Peter?
Yes, absolutely right. So I think maybe one answer, this is pretty vague, Carrie, and you can push us on this, is the connection between the idea of the family and worship and the house, which becomes, in a way, for each family, a kind of sacred or sentimental space.
What's your reaction to that, Carrie? I want to find out if Peter's right or not before I confirm his point.
I mean, I think that sounds pretty reasonable, and it would make sense to me that if the house is a sacred space, then you'll obviously, if you own your own house, you'll put more work into it.
Yep.
You'll treat it differently than if you're just leasing from someone else.
So here's my point that builds off yours and Peter's, which is in the 20th century, in Catholic parishes, homeowners were far more reticent to leave their older homes and move out to the suburbs because they needed that connection with the sacred space, which was still the church. Uh-huh. And even in the face of white flight after World War II, Catholics, ethnic groups that were still attached to that sacred space of the church, moved out of their homes at much lower rates than Protestants.
That is so cool, Brian. And I remember as a Protestant child, you went to the church that was most convenient, and it was a marketplace of churches. There wasn't any particular
church. The church of your choice.
The church of your choice, and that would be the one that's in walking distance.
Right.
But in a way, any Protestant church is good
it's
for
as
any
good as
Protestant,
another.
Right? And people do switch from Methodist to Presbyterian. I know I'm talking about mainstream more than evangelical sects today, but that idea that maybe the important place or site is the home and what happens there, and that's where you do honor to God. It's not necessarily in the place of worship.
Because the home is just a portable container for the family.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is the real object of moral formation
yep,
and so forth.
You got it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
We've got another call. This one's from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Mary Kim, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hey.
Thank you.
Well, it's lovely to have you with us in our home here, in our various
I'm happy to be here.
Studios. So tell us what's on your mind.
Well, I've been thinking about how, you know, increasingly there's this emphasis on larger and larger homes.
Ooh.
That include fairly specific, like almost single function rooms, like a media center or a family room or a
man cave.
Playroom.
Right.
Exactly.
The scotch tape room is my favorite.
Right, the wrapping paper room.
Yes, exactly.
And I'm wondering, you know, and so these things are very clearly defined, and I think that even carries out into the exterior of the space, so that our borders and our boundaries are so clearly defined.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how that, you know, how that's changed over time, and also how that may affect, you know, our sort of notions of privacy and connectedness or not connectedness or isolation from each other.
Mary Kim, this is a totally fabulous show-long question. Where to begin on what ever larger house has done to American life, and where does it come from? Is it un-American?
Well, it would have to begin the whole idea of privacy in the late 18th century, wouldn't it, Peter?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, where it comes from really is a change in domestic architecture and the interior design of homes so that people would have separate bedrooms. When there was enough space, and the great thing about American houses is they were poorly built and they were built not to last. That's planned obsolescence. Building materials were cheap, and there was plenty of space, so it was possible to fulfill fantasies of having personal space pretty early.
You know, I guess I would have thought, Peter, that the idea of private bedrooms and all, I don't know if that was an English idea that we imported, or did it grow up because there was enough space here?
Yeah, well, I think it is a combination. In a way, I think the best way to understand American ambitions in home building is to see them from the beginning as gentrifiers, as trying to build up and live up to their notion of the aristocracy or the gentry. And that's what the middle class is, after all. It's mass aristocracy. It's having knockoff products, mass-produced, that were originally the kinds of things that aristocrats would have.
And when I go back to my home in, you know, Pagebrook Manor or whatever,
yes, exactly, right?
You know, right.
So yeah, I think that's a theme that goes through American history as we've both built houses and filled them with things that that speak to our status, our sense of who we are. And it's interesting that privacy is such an issue because on one hand, we want to show off. It's conspicuous consumption. On the other hand, then that space within is supposed to be sacredly ours.
Yeah, and Mary Kim, I just want to say in the 20th century, the reason that houses get bigger and bigger is we fill them with a lot of stuff. And a lot of that stuff has kind of a specialized function, and perhaps the most important example of that is the television. where there might be one television on the block in the early 1950s. You went over to your neighbors to watch a TV.
Yeah, happened to me. I'm that
very
old.
Quickly mm-hmm. becomes something that occupies the center of the house, so much so that it becomes the television room. And
right.
I visited a very wealthy house few months ago. It wasn't in a gated community. It was in a doubly gated community. And
how did you get in
and,
there
and
anyway?
There was that's another show, Peter. And there was a television in virtually every room in
my dream.
The house. Yeah.
right.
But, you know, I figure the 21st century is equal game for everybody, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
So I can go ahead
go
and say
for it.
You bet.
So, Mary Kim, I don't know if you've noticed or if you've read, but the houses are shrinking again.
Yeah.
That the pattern that you described, I think, is a historically specific moment. You know, mm-hmm. what we think of McMansions, right?
Yeah.
So they're very much 80s, 90s, and the early 21st century. But now they're no longer not only possible. We've decided that we don't like them, that they are wrong,
right.
that they're gauche
right.
or too much. So, I mean, you're asking this question.
Yeah,
so
you want to know more about her. Yeah, what's going
yeah.
on, Mary Kim? Tell us about your house. Take us on a virtual tour of your house.
How many TVs do you
yeah.
have?
Well, fortunately, we only have – I'm happy to say we only have one, but there are two things I think that have like –
Wait a second. More importantly, how many radios do you have?
oh, I only have one in my house, but mostly I listen not at home.
Okay.
Right.
I
just
listen
so you
online
listen.
Or in
just
my car.
Just so long as you listen.
Well, so two things. One, my husband and I did happen to fall in love with this old Victorian house, which is, it's got the sort of smaller defined rooms, but it's much more space than we ever really needed. So, it's this an odd kind of mixture for me, the way I feel about it. I mean, I love being in an older home that we can, mm-hmm. Preserve something of the past. But at the same time, it does in some ways satisfy those, those ambitions that you spoke of earlier,
right.
that we would have all the space to fill with all of our stuff.
I bet the bathrooms are small and the public spaces
are
big. And then that's the difference between these engorged houses in the late 20th century is the public spaces would shrink and the TV would have its own room or the TVs would have their separate rooms and there would be the man cave and so forth.
What you're pointing to, Mary Kim, is something even like the size of a house is deeply historically rooted, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're cursed with the self-knowledge that you need to decorate it in a way historically specific.
Well, that's right. She's a victim of her own house, and now she has a stewardship. She has to take care of that house.
That's right.
Right. Whoa.
Right.
And that's a house that's built to last, and you're in charge. Mary Kim, good luck, and thanks so much for calling.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, guys, we've been talking for the last hour about the dream of American homeownership, but a lot of people have made money off the nightmare of homeownership, and I'm not talking about those people who are handing out subprime mortgages. I'm talking about Hollywood. I mean, just think about it. Just recently, I've seen all these ads for movies, Dream House and Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, and if you can believe it, it's the third installment of Paranormal Activity. But this genre of sort of the modern haunted house was created in the 1970s and 1980s, the post-Nixon years, when in movies like Poltergeist and the Amityville Horror, the houses themselves really take a starring role, and a scary starring role. Now, why would that be? Well, fortunately, we were able to ask New York Magazine film critic David Edelstein to scare us up an answer.
American men got back from World War II where they had seen truly horrible things, and they dreamed about a country that would be safe, where they could keep their families safe from the kind of things that they had seen overseas. They dreamed of of a national highway system. They dreamed of a suburb. And the 70s, on the other side of the counterculture, when we were suddenly laughing at Leave It to Beaver, we were suddenly laughing at the Brady Bunch, many of us getting high and watching those old episodes, that's when we began to question the very foundation of the American dream.
They're here.
Films like Poltergeist really prey on our deep suspicion that this is not a way of life that we can sustain. Perhaps the houses are very pretty and freshly painted, and there are beautiful gardens, but somewhere or other, someone has done something wrong. There is some original sin. And in the case of Poltergeist, of course, we learn it's become a joke. It's become a cliche. It was built over an Indian graveyard.
Son of a bitch, you moved the cemetery, but you left the bodies, didn't you? You son of a bitch, you left the bodies and you only moved the headstones! You only moved the headstones!
I just wish that all those people hadn't died here. I mean, dude, a guy kills his whole family? Doesn't that bother you?
Sure, but houses don't have memories.
Well, this is the Amityville Horror, which is supposedly based on a true story. We've since discovered that it was, in fact, a scam, though it fooled a great many people. What's interesting about that movie is that you see that this idea of this house, it's not only haunted in and of itself, but it gets inside. It stirs the inner demons.
Would you please leave that damn fire on and listen to me?
Going anywhere. You're the one that wanted a house. This is it, so just shut up.
They chose this house. They wanted to move there because they felt that it would change their lives. The way we all feel that we're going to be able to relaunch our lives, we're going to be able to start afresh. And this demon here manages to prey on the very things that this house was supposed to be strengthening.
What do you want from us?
God, this is my house!
In this culture in particular, we invest so much of our hopes and dreams, so much of our identity is invested in our houses, in our real estate. We've become increasingly obsessed with real estate at a time when so many people are unable to afford it and are, in fact, being dispossessed. Now, it's sort of funny when you think of dispossession versus possession by demons. Well, in some ways, the ghost in the haunted house is the most efficient foreclosure artist in history, because you buy something and you think, it's mine. I own this house. I own this land. And then you are slapped upside the head. You understand somebody comes out of the deep, dark past and says, you don't own this. You don't own anything. You don't even own your own flesh. I can get inside you. I can get inside these walls. I can get into your baby's room. I can bring this house and everything it's standing on and everything it represents in your pathetic bourgeois world. I can bring it crashing to the ground, and you don't have a chance against me. You don't have literally a prayer.
David Edelstein is a film critic whose reviews appear in New York Magazine and are heard on NPR's Fresh Air and CBS Sunday Morning.
Come on, let's build a house. Come on, let's build a house.
And that's going to do it for us today. For a great list of books, sources, and completely unsubstantiated videos of real-life poltergeists, head on over to our website, backstoryradio.org, where you can join the conversation. Don't be a stranger.
Special thanks today to Camille Wells, Adam Rome, Gwen Wright, Robert Schiller, and Miller Center Fellow Robert Henderson.
Backstory is produced by Jess Ingebretson, Eric Mennel, and Anna Pinkert. Our senior producer is Tony Field.
Jamal Milner is our technical director. Nell Beschenstein is our researcher, and Frank Cirillo is our intern. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the University of Virginia, Weinstein Properties, an anonymous donor, and the History Channel, history made every day.
Peter Onuf and Brian Ballow are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.